Welcome to the DMEMAC National CER Education Task Force Oxygen Ask the Contractor teleconference. All lines will remain in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session. Today's conference call is being recorded and transcribed. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you for participating in today's call. I will now turn the conference over to Ms. Leah Nguyen. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Simon. Hello, I am Leah Nguyen from the Provider Communications Group here at CMS. I would like to welcome you to the Oxygen Ask the Contractor teleconference presented by the DMEMAC National CERT Education Task Force. This call is scheduled for 90 minutes. Today's call is being recorded and transcribed and will be posted to the CMS CERT webpage at www.cms.gov/CERT under the Providers tab in approximately 2 weeks. It will also be offered as an encore presentation available on all DMEMAC websites. You'll receive a listserv message from your contractor letting you know when the encore recording, written transcripts, FAQs, and written responses to your questions are available. In a unique approach to reducing common comprehensive error rate testing, or CERT errors, DMEMAC jurisdictions A, B, C, and D have collaborated to form the DMEMAC CERT Education Task Force. The task force has identified common national errors and has developed consistent educational messages, which are used by all four DMEMAC jurisdictions in support of reducing errors. Today, the task force will conduct a national Ask the Contractors teleconference specific to oxygen policies. Members of the DMEMAC CERT Education Task Force and knowledgeable CMS policy experts will be available to answer your questions on oxygen and oxygen equipment for the following categories: coverage criteria, testing requirements, certificate of medical necessity, documentation, and others. At this time, I would like to introduce Jody Witten from Jurisdiction D, Denise Winsop from Jurisdiction A, Nina Gregory from Jurisdiction B, and Mark Loney from Jurisdiction C. And now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to our first speaker, Jody Witten from Jurisdiction D.
Thank you, Leah. And again, my name is Jody Witten, and I am an education consultant with Noridian, the Jurisdiction D, DMEMAC. Again, we just want to thank everyone for joining us today. Before we open up the lines for questions, each jurisdiction would like to go over some common questions and concerns that we received prior to this ACT. And just to let you know, many of the pre-submitted questions were answered directly from the LCD or policy article in all jurisdictions, and encourage suppliers to look and review both of those documents. Now, documentation is to support the medical necessity is a requirement for suppliers. Many suppliers have incorporated thorough intake business practices to verify that coverage criteria is met, and medical records are available upon request, including testing results. Now I'd like to go over just a few of the common questions that we receive. The first one being, most physicians do finger pulse testing, which does not print out a report. Would documenting this result in the patient's medical record chart notes be acceptable? The answer is yes. Finger pulse testing reports in the patient's medical record is acceptable, making sure that's available upon request. Question two, when oxygen testing is obtained during exercise, must there be documentation of additional testing? And the answer to that is also yes. In order for a beneficiary to qualify for oxygen based on exercise, there must be documentation in the patient's medical record of 3 tests taken during one session. These tests would be the test at rest without oxygen, the second test would be the testing during exercise without oxygen, and the third test is testing during oxygen or during exercise with oxygen applied. This is going to demonstrate there's an improvement of the patient's hypoxemia. But also note that only the second qualifying test is the test that's reported on the certificate of medical necessity. And my third question is something from the patient's medical record at the physician's office showing qualifying saturation levels sufficient to document medical necessity for oxygen, or is more required? The answer to this is Yes. First of all, there is multiple requirements that must be documented in order to justify reimbursement. While many are listed in the LCD, others come from the NCD or CMS manual or regulations and statutes. So suppliers are expected to be knowledgeable about all of these requirements and convey these relevant information to their referral sources. And now I'd like to turn the line over to Denise Winsock from Jurisdiction A. Denise?
Thank you, Jody. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Denise Winsock, and I'm an outreach specialist from NHIC Jurisdiction A. I'm going to review some questions again regarding coverage concerns, but first I want to remind everyone that not all requirements are outlined in the LCD. As Jody just stated, multiple statute regulations and CMS manuals have additional requirements that must be followed. We do encourage suppliers to discuss this with their referring physicians and or referral sources to dispel this inaccurate perception that coverage is only based on what's in the LCD. Now, the first question is there a form provided that we can print out for the doctors to fill in that specifically address all the requirements? If so, where can we find it? And no, there is no single form that can be used to meet all the Medicare documentation requirements for an item. There is an oxygen and oxygen equipment certificate of medical necessity attached to the LCD. However, the certificate of medical necessity does not address all documentation, and the CMN answers must be backed up by a comprehensive medical record that supports the need for the item. The second question, when will the 6-month contemporaneous notes be part of the LCD and required to have on file? There is no specific time frame to support continuous need or use. Reviewers will assess each patient separately to determine medical necessity based on the records that are available. Realistically, oxygen is a serious drug that should be monitored by the physician periodically. The third question, if the patient is seen in the emergency room for one condition and they address a respiratory problem at the same time, can the ER doctor order oxygen if necessary? And per the LCD criteria 4, the qualifying blood gas study was obtained under the following conditions. One, if the qualifying blood gas study is performed during an inpatient hospital stay, the reported test must be one obtained closest to, but no earlier than 2 days prior to the hospital discharge date. Or, if the qualifying blood gas study is not performed during an inpatient hospital stay, the reported test must be performed while the patient is in a chronic stable state, such as not during a period of acute illness or an exacerbation of their underlying disease. Testing obtained during an acute event usually would not meet this standard. And the second part of that question is, if not, should the patient then be referred to the ER doctor or by the ER doctor to their primary physician to be qualified? And yes, if the patient was not in a chronic stable state, to be tested while they were at the hospital. And now I would like to turn the line over to Nina Gregory from Jurisdiction B.
Thank you, Denise. My name is Nina Gregory, and I am an education consultant with National Government Services, the Jurisdiction B DMEMAC. Suppliers must be able to provide documentation upon request that the beneficiary has met the specified testing requirements per the medical policy. So whether qualifying under Group 1 or Group 2, the reported blood gas values must meet the requirements. Now I'd like to go over some more common documentation questions that we've received. Question number 1, what defines exercise when a patient is being tested in the doctor's office? Well, per the LCD, when oxygen is covered based on an oxygen study obtained during exercise, there must be documentation of 3 oxygen studies in the patient's medical record: testing at rest without oxygen, testing during exercise without oxygen, and testing during exercise with oxygen applied to demonstrate the improvement of the hypoxemia. All 3 tests must be performed within the same testing session. Only the qualifying test value or testing during exercise without oxygen is reported on the CMN. The other results do not have to be routinely submitted but must be available upon request. Suppliers are encouraged to refer to the published clinical literature for information about oximetry testing and exercise testing protocols. The second question, does an overnight oximetry test need to be any certain length of time? No, there is no specified minimum sleep time. The testing requirement requires a minimum of 5 minutes of qualifying values in order to meet the standard for coverage. Question number 3. Can a home health agency, with an order for oxygen from the doctor, complete the oxygen saturation to qualify patients for oxygen? And no, home health agencies are not considered a qualified provider or a qualified laboratory for purposes of the oxygen and oxygen equipment LCD. Testing must be done by a Medicare-qualified provider, for example, a Part A provider, a laboratory, or independent diagnostic testing facility. And now I'd like to turn the line over to Mark Kalani from Jurisdiction C.
Thank you, Nina. My name is Mark Loney, and I'm a member of the Provider Outreach and Education team here at Cigna Government Services, the DME MAC for Jurisdiction C. Today I'm going to be talking about the Certificate of Medical Necessity, or CMN, which is an important component of the documentation requirements of the oxygen policy. A CMN, which has been signed and dated by the treating physician, is required for all oxygen claims billed to Medicare. It is important to note that both an initial and a recertification CMN are required to justify the continued need of oxygen therapy. In addition, the CMN may act as a substitute for a written order if it is sufficiently detailed. Now I'm going to go over three common questions regarding CMNs. Question number one, if the required physician reevaluation is not performed within 90 days prior to recertification, but it is performed at a later date, what should be entered as the recertification date on the oxygen CMN? The answer there is, in that situation, the date of the late physician visit should be entered as the recertification date on the CMN. Question number two, if a beneficiary has stationary oxygen equipment and portable oxygen equipment is added, do I need a new initial CMN? The answer there is no. A revised CMN is required in this situation and not a new initial. In addition, I want to point out that Chapter 4 of the Supplier Manual contains a list of common scenarios for initial, revised, and recertification CMNs. Lastly, question number three is, how long is a CMN good for? Most beneficiaries who require home oxygen therapy beyond a few months are going to require it lifelong. Therefore, once that CMN, which is specifically Form CMS-484, recertification establishes that the medical necessity continues, subsequent recertifications are not routinely required.
Thank you, Mark.
Go ahead, Maria.
We have now completed the presentation portion of this call, and we will move on to the question and answer session. Before we begin, I would like to remind everyone that this call is being recorded and transcribed. Before asking your question, please state your name and the name of your organization. In an effort to get to as many of your questions as possible, we ask that you limit your question to just one. All right, Simon, you may open the line for questions.
We will now open the lines for a question and answer session. To ask a question, press star followed by the number 1 on your touch-tone phone. To remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Please state your name and organization prior to asking a question and pick up your handset before asking your question to assure clarity. Please note your line will remain open during the time you are asking your question, so anything you say or any background noise will be heard in the conference. One moment, please, for your first question. Your first question comes from the line of Sheila Stretti. Your line is open.
The question is, on a lot of the documentation that's required, it's really a physician standard of practice, not ours. How do we deal with that?
Sheila, this is Jody from Jurisdiction D. What jurisdiction are you calling from?
D.
D as in boy?
Yes, Nina.
Hi, this is Nina. So, I'm sorry, can you repeat your question one more time?
The question, a lot of the documentation that's required that we have to find really applies to a physician standard of care practice. Mm-hmm. At what point and how do we get that information? How do we deal with that? Because it's their standard of practice that they are doing or not doing. How do you recommend that we get the documentation that you're requiring? Because physicians are not aware of all of that, no matter how much education. We're shut out of their offices for educating, and they're obviously not getting it from their sources.
Right. I definitely do understand the problem with that. What we recommend is definitely that suppliers educate their physicians and work hand-in-hand with their physicians. We have Dear Physician letters out there that we definitely do recommend that you supply to your physician offices and try to walk them through what Medicare policy guidelines are. And then, you know, definitely try to obtain the documentation that supports the coverage criteria up front as much as possible so that, you know ahead of time whether your beneficiary needs coverage or does not, and that way you can make a business decision at that time. We are trying to educate the physician side as much as possible, but we are limited in that area.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry.
Your next question comes from the line of Jackie Montville. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. Actually, this is Judy Bunn. One clarification on question 11. The answer states that the existing coverage and documentation requirements must be met except that the original test done while the patient was in the hospice may be used. And I would assume that that needs to be within 30 days of the start date of the service. Would that be correct?
Judy, again, this is Jody from Jurisdiction D. What jurisdiction do you bill to?
I'm sorry, Region B.
D as in boy?
Yes. Hello, Nina.
Hi, Judy. Are you talking about on the pre-submitted questions?
Yes, I'm sorry. A patient who's currently on oxygen is moving into my area or is disenrolled from a home hospice that required oxygen during that hospice stay. In those situations, is the patient required to see a physician within 30 days prior to the initial setup? The answer is yes. All of the existing coverage and documentation requirements must be met, except that the original testing done while the patient was in the hospice may be used as the qualifying test. I would assume that that test needs to be within 30 days of the initial date?
Correct.
Okay. My real question is in regards to number 21, though. The question, when oxygen is being bled into a CPAP or a BiPAP, what are the testing and documentation requirements? Do the sleep study SAPs qualify the patient? The answer was pretty interesting, basically saying that if the patient's got OSA and has hypoxia, they're not in a chronic stable state. Maybe I'm misinterpreting the answer, but in that case, any patient that's got hypoxia wouldn't be in a chronic stable state. This answer, I'm not understanding. It's not making a lot of sense. Could you guys please clarify?
Well, Judy, that we had assistance with our medical director, so maybe we would have to take that back and have that on the after the call Q&A document to clarify. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excuse me, this is Denise Winsock. Dr. Hughes would like to address that question as well, if that's okay?
Absolutely, please.
Thank you.
Can you guys hear me? I don't even know how this conference system works. So.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Judy, the idea of chronic stable state, and this was asked in actually one of the earlier questions, this is a central testing requirement for oxygen. You guys all know this. What that means is not that the patient may not be sick, but that everything else that can be done to treat the conditions that are causing the hypoxia have been done to the best that you're able to get them done. And then if there is hypoxia left, at that point, then it is assumed that that hypoxia can be treated by the administration of oxygen. So we'll use COPD for an example. If I've got COPD and I've got an exacerbation or pneumonia on top of it and I'm sick with that, and you do a saturation, I'm going to be probably hypoxic. Certainly you can get a qualifying number, but that's not my real baseline level when I'm in the chronic stable state. So you've got to treat my bronchitis, cure my pneumonia, make sure I'm on my regular COPD medicines, and that everything else is as stable as can be, and then you check my saturations, and if I have a qualifying value, then I'm in the chronic stable state, and the qualifying value qualifies me for oxygen. The same thing is true with obstructive sleep apnea. Obstructive sleep apnea by itself makes people hypoxic, and they're hypoxic because of the blockage in their throat that interferes with their breathing. Oxygen is not the treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. CPAP or oral devices or weight loss or surgery are all the treatments for obstructive sleep apnea. So if I go to the sleep lab and I'm getting a sleep study done and they say, oh, gee, you have obstructive sleep apnea and your O2 saturation is 68%, you can't qualify for oxygen with that sleep test because you have not treated the obstructive sleep apnea. And you have to do that. And get them on their CPAP, get an adequate level, get them treated, get their oral device in, whichever of the treatment modalities you use. And once that obstructive sleep apnea is under control and reasonably treated, then you test them again. And then if they remain hypoxic, then you can add oxygen in. But you can't do it during the diagnostic portion of the sleep study because you haven't treated their obstructive sleep apnea. So kind of a long answer, but a real important concept. So that helped.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Cindy Fenza. Your line is open.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cindy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What jurisdiction are you calling from?
I'm jurisdiction A.
Great.
My question is, I would like to know from you, all you folks, exactly what documentation needs to be written on the prescription prior to dispensing the oxygen. There seems to be some confusion within my organization.
Hi. Actually, right at the moment, we don't have the list in front of us, but you would definitely have, do you have a particular question about one particular item? But
I do.
Okay, what item were you questioning?
Do the oxygen saturation levels have to be on the prescription, or may they be included in the patient medical record available if need be?
No, that would not have to be on the prescription. I just didn't want to answer and leave something out that does have to be, but that definitely does not. That would be in your records. It would also be on the certificate of medical necessity, but it does not have to be on the actual order itself.
Thank you very much for clarifying that for me.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jennifer Delaney. Your line is open.
Hi.
Hi, Jennifer. What jurisdiction are you calling from?
I'm calling from jurisdiction C.
All righty.
And my question is, when a patient starts in a 36-month rental period after their initial 5 years of the oxygen service, the policies state that the qualifying test can be the same test from the most recent CMN. And we're getting CO50 denials for the test date being older than 30 days prior to the date of service on the CMN when the test issued is the test from the last CMN on file. We are under the impression they're not supposed to deny for that, so I was wondering if anybody could tell me why they are.
Yes, this is Mark with Jurisdiction C. And the policy is worded to say that I believe it's the most recent qualifying test on file, which could be from your research CMN in your situation about 4 years old. Keep in mind, though, the other things, the national coverage determinations and the statutes that come into play that talk about contemporaneous data and contemporaneous notes to support that. So if you start over after a 60-month cap is reached and a reviewer looks at that documentation, they're going to look for something more recent, more contemporaneous than that four-year-old SAT.
They will look for it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jennifer Heff. Your line is open.
Hi, Jennifer. What jurisdiction are you calling from? Jennifer, is your phone on mute?
Jennifer Hess, your line is open.
I'm sorry, this is Stephanie Kuhlman from Jurisdiction D. I have a question on a CMN. Can you hear me? Yes, and you said Jurisdiction D is in dog?
Yes.
Oh, righty, go ahead. on a CMN, if I have initial and a research, and now I have a revised CMN because the patient transferred services from another provider to us, is it okay to have the initial date, the research date, and the revised date all on one CMN? We would have all three CMNs, or at least the initial and the research, but then when we got the revised, we had all three dates on there. Is that allowed?
So you're going to have the initial date, the same initial date that we have in our system, the recertification date, and the revision date as well. That is absolutely okay.
Okay. And only one question at a time, is that correct?
That is correct. We have quite a few on the phone today.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jerry McLam. Your line is open.
Yes, I'm calling from Regency, and I have a question. Earlier, one of your presenters talked about exercise for qualifying, and we understand that you have to have the three tests, being the exercise test, but what defines as exercise? Is it a patient getting up to move from the exam table to the chair? Is it them walking 50 feet down the hall in the doctor's office? Or do they have to do a 6-minute exercise test?
Again, this is Mark with Jurisdiction C. I don't know that the LCD actually defines a specific type or length of exercise at all. Again, we're gonna follow the published clinical literature there about exercise testing protocols. We have to keep in mind our demographic, the beneficiaries and their capabilities. Each one would have a different set of circumstances or criteria that would qualify them for exercise based on their activity levels and all of that. So there's not a specific piece of data or time frame that we're looking for.
Because the doctor's office could. It's whoever's performing the test on the patient, determination on whether it's exercise or not. So if a nurse is saying that the patient's at rest but he's actually standing up, how is that documented?
Well, I don't know where a note about just standing up would be considered exercise, but it would be up, to the case in each physician's office.
If you sit down that the patient has walked, y'all consider that exercise?
For some patients, walking would certainly create more hypoxia than sitting down, certainly. If in the routine of their activities of daily living, if walking is the most strenuous thing they do and that creates events for them, then we can look at that as exercise.
Mark, this is Dr. Hughes. Would you mind if I interrupted you?
Not at all. Go ahead.
Certainly what Mark is saying with regards to the amount of exertion and the amount of energy that any individual has to expend, that's going to be very variable. So, I had one guy who worked in the mines for a million years and was a big smoker on top of it, and getting out of bed and changing the chairs just exhausted him and used every molecule of oxygen in his body. So I think the point Mark is making is that how much activity is needed to get a patient to desaturate will vary depending on the patient. But that's not really what exercise testing is all about. Exercise testing is a real lab test. Okay? It's not just, do whatever you want and get a measurement. It's a real lab test, and there are rules that are about how it's supposed to be done, how much exertion the person being tested is supposed to put out, and so on and so forth. And so the national policy, our policy talks about tests in those contexts. We're talking about real lab tests. We're not talking about homemade, do-it-yourself kind of mechanisms. So the answer to your question is, what do you have to do an exercise test? You should be talking to the respiratory therapy department at your local hospital, saying, if I send a patient in to do exercise testing, what are they going to have to do? You should be talking to the pulmonary doctors in town who have labs in their offices. There are a number of techniques and protocols. You can walk on treadmills. You can go up and down stairs. You can ride a bike, and there's a walk test. But they're all controlled. They're all done by supervised and trained people. They're all designed to get a standardized, reliable, repeatable, accurate measurement. And so I know there are lots of physicians who informally walk patients around the halls and do this and that and the other, and they may desaturate, but that's not an official real exercise test. So you just, again, the way testing is done varies around the country, so you've got to talk to your local docs and hospitals to see the methods that are popular in your area. But just be aware, it's a real test. It's not something you just, every individual doctor gets to make up on their own. So I hope that helps.
Well, one question, now that you've clarified that, because that's, you know, we were hearing from our RTs that, you know, you had to do a certain standardized testing for this, but my question now to you is that, so if you have a patient that is in the doctor's office and has been a smoker all his life and he has chronic obstructive sleep or chronic bronchitis and he's COPD and he's emphysema, but he's not been on oxygen, if he is sitting on the exam table and his test is 89, which qualifies for 3 months, but then he stands up and walks to the door while the pulse ox is still on him and he, you know, desaturates to 85, would that be an at-rest test, or is that...
No, because he's moving at rest. I mean, all of these words are defined. I mean, if you're in the hospital and I need an at-rest test, you've got to be laying around for like 30 minutes. There are rules. All these are technical terms that mean something in the context of official testing. And we in our DME world tend to be a little informal about this because we're dealing out of the hospital and so on. But the reality is, even for at-rest saturation, overnight testing, all of the different things that can be done, these are real lab tests, and there are rules about how you do them. And the words describing the conditions under which the test is done, they're all standardized. And the reason for that is so that when I say, gee, I did an at-rest test on my patient here in Pennsylvania, and when I send that person to Tennessee to see Dr. Hoover, he knows exactly what was done with that test because it's all standardized. And so, you know, when the NCD, the LCDs talk about these tests, all these concepts come from the world of medicine. These are not as informal, make it up as you go along kind of concepts.
And I understand and I agree and I appreciate your help with it. And is there any time that these standards of tests and the way it's supposed to be performed are going to be added to the LCD?
No, absolutely not. This is just the everyday practice of medicine. When you do your, when you work in a medical field, this is stuff you got to know. These are not Medicare rules. Medicare says you need to have a test, and that the entity that does the test has to be a qualified provider of laboratory tests. Well, now maybe you begin to see the reason why it says that. These are real tests, and they have to be done according to the standards for doing tests. The people that run labs, the people that do IDTFs, those sorts of things, it's their business to know how to do that. I'm a family doctor. If I want to know about exercise testing, I can go talk to the American Academy of Respiratory Medicine. I can look on guidelines.gov. I can search the literature. I can learn about it. But these are not Medicare rules about what at-rest means. This is not a Medicare rule about what you need to do for an exercise, how an exercise test is done. These are the medical rules. When you do an exercise test, this is what it means. And so, you know, that stuff is never going to be in the policy.
Okay. But it's our responsibility as suppliers to let these facilities know that when they are doing the exercise tests that they are qualified to do and they understand the guidelines to do them, that we have to have these three testing results.
The only thing that Medicare specifies about exercise testing are the three numbers that Medicare wants reported.
Right.
Medicare doesn't care whether you walk on a treadmill, whether you go up and down steps, whether you do a six-minute walk, whether you ride a bicycle, you know, which of the techniques that are done to do the test, Medicare doesn't care. All Medicare cares about is that it was a properly done test, whichever way they chose to do it, and that you got the three results reported.
Correct. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry we beat that to death, but that's also been a question folks have asked a lot over the years.
Yes, sir, and thank you very much.
Mark, sorry to intrude on you there.
No problem.
Your next question comes from the line of Sheila Van Kuyk. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm calling from Region B. We have several clients that are on oxygen concentrators greater than 4 liters per minute. They have now reached the 36-month cap, and when we're trying to bill for oxygen contents, Medicare is denying, stating that we've never billed for a portable. We want to know how we can get this fixed to be able to bill for the portable contents after the 36 months when they're greater than 4 liters.
Hi, this is Charity Bright from Jurisdiction B. I think I understood your question, but I just want to make sure. You're saying that you have patients who've not reached the 36-month cap?
They have already exceeded the 36 months.
They have exceeded the 36 months.
And they're on like 5-6 liters.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're trying to bill for oxygen portable tank contents because they've met that 36-month cap. We are getting denials due to the fact that we never billed for a portable unit.
Okay. Are you indicating in the narrative of your claim line in the NTE segment that the patient was on 4 liters or greater
yep.
during the 36-month cap? And
we have. In fact, we've submitted one person 3 times doing different narratives per Medicare's direction on what to put in it, and we're still keep getting denials on this one client.
Okay. Well, what we would have to do... I don't have access to the claim payment system to look to see what's causing that error to occur. We would have to look at some claim examples to determine what's causing that to happen. Have you contacted customer care and provided any examples to them to elevate?
Yes, I've gone to level 2, and they've given me a different way to put it in my HAO note. And we've changed the HAO note and then resubmitted it, and they still deny, stating that we never billed for the portable.
Okay. Nina, are you there?
Yes.
Can they send example, or can she send her contact information through the clinical education mailbox?
That would be perfect.
Okay. Can you give her that address so I make sure she gets it correctly?
Oh, yeah. Nina, we have it.
Okay.
we email you frequently.
Okay, yeah, if you'll send us your contact information, we will definitely get in touch with you and see what's going on with those claims.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Roynita Jefferson. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. My question is in regards to... complete documentation, wanting to know is if the doctor or the ordering physician puts all the information on the actual order, would that justify sufficient documentation, or would the information related to the testing and how it was done or performed, does that also need to be documented in the patient chart notes?
This is Jody from Jurisdiction D. Are you calling? What jurisdiction are you calling from?
B.
All righty. Nina?
Hi, this is Nina. No, the clinical information or the medical necessity information needs to come from the patient's comprehensive medical record. So just because you have the diagnosis on the order or many suppliers put medical necessity information on the order and it's completed, that does not cover you in an audit situation. So you must have your detailed written order,
your CMN, or they could be the same, and then you must have medical record documentation from the physician, from, you know, respiratory therapist, from whoever, to get the holistic picture of your patient and your proof of delivery and everything else to go with for an audit.
Okay. That's understandable to me. Not if I get the doctors to know. Okay. That's it.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Megan Jarecki. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm calling from Jurisdiction B. We also do billing for Jurisdiction B, too, but I was just wondering, does this clinical documentation need to be submitted when we submit our claims?
This is Jody from Jurisdiction D. Since I haven't had a chance to talk, I'll go ahead and answer that. But no, you don't need to have it submitted with your claim, your clinical documentation. You just need to make sure that it exists and is available upon request.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Janon Silber. Your line is open.
Hi, yes, I'm in Region C as in Cat, and I have a question about this contemporaneous medical records. It's something new that we've been noticing on the cert letters we've been receiving. I can't find anywhere on the Jurisdiction C website or on the LCD where it states that it's a requirement to have this type of record. And also, I was wanting to know, if it is a new requirement, what sort of documentation you're looking for.
This is Jody. Mark, were you going to answer that one?
I am. Sorry, I couldn't find my mute button. The language, you're talking about the contemporaneous data, you are seeing that in some of the cert response letters and other audit response letters. It is general language that governs the entire program, so you won't find it in any specific LCDs, but the need to have medical documentation that supports any claim that's being billed still exists. And that language is there in the documents that govern the entire program, the internet-only manuals and things like that. So the LCD is going to be specific, and it's going to be specific when necessary, but I guess we also need to keep in mind and not forget that we're always going to have documentation from within a reasonably recent time frame to support any claim that's being billed.
Okay. But based off of the way that it reads on these letters, is it stating within 6 months of the date of service on claim? That's very, like, random, because you're not necessarily auditing all at the same time frame. So, in other words, you could be hitting me with this on a second-month claim, or you could be hitting me with this on an 11th-month claim, and yet I'm required to have medical records within the last 6 months of any of those dates of services. So every month am I needing to get, you know, medical records on these patients? Or what sort of documentation are you wanting? And is it literally within 6 months of the date of the claim date? Or how does this work?
I don't know that there's a specific time frame. Certainly the type of item that's being billed, and we'll stick to oxygen because that's the topic of today's call. Oxygen is something where you're going to want to have fairly recent documentation. It is a drug that's being used to treat and manage an ongoing disease, so the documentation about that should be generated fairly frequently. There's not a specific timeline set. I would agree with you that I hear the time frame of 6 months, if that's a good rule of thumb to follow.
Well, that's what it says on the. I'm reading from one of the cert letters. It says contemporaneous within 6 months of the date of service on claim, medical records confirming that the beneficiary continues to use oxygen in the home.
Right.
My problem with that being that depending on when the date of service is that I filed, the patient may not, for whatever reason, have been to the doctor within the last 6 months, and I have seen where they've actually denied my claim based off of that. The problem with that being is I can't expect my patients to constantly be going to the doctor worried that you're going to audit one of my claims and I'm not going to have records within the last 6 months. You know, it might have been outside, it might have been 7 months ago they were at the doctor and I've had a denial. So
okay.
I figure out what you're wanting in your records, and is this for sure a 6 month limit here or...
No, and again, I guess part of me, what letter you're speaking of, I'm not, and during the cert process, you'll get a remit, but I'm not sure what letter it is you're reading. But again, I can't point you to a specific time frame. Certainly, speaking directly about oxygen, you're going to want to have recent contemporaneous data. It's a chronic condition. If you get a denial or from whatever appeals or whatever audit process that you don't agree with, there is the appeals process, and you can use that if you feel that your data supports the need for the item. But I can't tell you with any certainty that there's a specific time frame that you have to adhere to. It is contemporaneous data, keeping in mind the type of equipment that you're billing.
Okay, and I am speaking of oxygen because that's the only thing I've received these letters on is oxygen. What sort of information are they looking for in the medical record? Does it need to specifically state that the patient has at that visit? I mean, the patient is using oxygen, or could it be a visit just regarding their overall respiratory care?
I would expect. When we're looking at documentation specifically for an oxygen patient, that if they are seeing their treating physician, that there is a discussion, at least some however quick it may be, but there is some discussion about the use of the oxygen. Again, we're managing a chronic condition with that therapy. If there is a discussion about their overall respiratory situation and they're on oxygen, we would expect that the documentation would reflect that showing that they're on oxygen.
Unfortunately, I think my problem that I'm running into is I have pulmonologists who are treating patients with COPD, and they're going in, you know, for a follow-up and or for treatment for a bronchitis or something like that, and the pulmonologist is aware that they're on oxygen, but they're not notating it in that office visit. What do I do in those circumstances?
Each interaction, I realize we're talking about very specific circumstances that you face on a daily basis, and we're trying to answer in general terms. But
right.
Each circumstance is, I guess, going to stand on its own in a lot of cases. You're going to need the documentation to support your claim. Yes, you're going to rely on the doctor or other medical professionals to generate that documentation, but you have to be... the expert, if you will, and know that the documentation that you have on hand supports your claim, or the documentation that you can access if that's the way you choose to do it. So I can't give you a specific direction other than ongoing, be a partner with that referral source, ongoing education about the kind of documentation that you need. The physician's notes in their billing to Medicare can undergo the same kind of auditing. So if they're treating and managing an ongoing condition and not making any notes about it, that would be something that would be in their own practice as well, something to focus on. So I can't give you one fail-proof situation to handle everything, but just make sure, since you're the one doing the claim, it's your NCI attached to it, that you have the documentation or can access it to support it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Luann Getty. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hi, Luann. How can we help you? What jurisdiction do you bill to?
Region A.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay. We have a respiratory therapist on staff, and we want to know how soon after we deliver the oxygen do we send him out to examine the patient?
That's not a requirement of Medicare for the therapist to go out and examine the patient. That's nothing that we would require for them to be for you to be paid for oxygen with.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
you would, I just want to add too, you would definitely want to make sure that something's going on, make sure that the work, the equipment's in working condition all of the time, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a respiratory therapist, so you would periodically though want to check on the equipment and be sure it's in working condition.
Okay, that we do.
Great, thank you.
And how do I hang up from this so you don't...
You could just hit mute on your phone.
Okay, thank you.
And also, Jody? This is Jody from Jurisdiction D, and I would like to also just recommend that everybody be aware that there's supplier standards, not supplier standards, it's quality standards under the CMS website that need to be followed as well, that you have obtained through your accrediting organizations. Was somebody else going to speak?
We're actually going to move on to our next question here.
Alrighty.
Your next question comes from the line of Lori Brown. Your line is open.
Thank you. We actually bill all four jurisdictions. And I'm looking for some information that would tack to a question that Mark had previously answered. Common scenarios 8 and 9 independently address the late physician visit and the retesting outside of the 30-day window. But can you direct us on the restart date when the patient has both a late physician reevaluation and a late retest when the qualified retesting is required at the time of recertification? And specifically when the retest is after the physician reevaluation date.
This is Jody. So this is more of a testing question, right, as far as if they receive late testing as well as a late office visit?
Yes, and the testing follows the office visit. It's not in your common scenarios. They're addressed independently, and they both tell you to use the physician date, visit date. But if the test is after the physician date, I think that's creating conflict.
Correct. You want to make sure you're following, this is Jody again from Jurisdiction D, you want to make sure that you're following the rules and regulations regarding requiring a new test. There's a few times when you actually require a new test from the original. I believe group 2 patients need to have a new test prior to their recertification, but I don't believe the other ones require the new test. So, and Nina, you are doing the testing requirements. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
And it would be specifically on your group 1 patients who have a length of need less than lifetime and would be required to be retested within the last 30 days of your initial cert period.
All right, so you're talking about testing for the recertification?
Yes.
Yeah, and that needs to be done 12 months after the initial certification.
Correct. But that doesn't always happen. We're not all, you know, patients get sick, they cancel their appointments. So mm-hmm. when it does not occur, and we have a conflict with both of these occurring after they were due, and we've asked this question on various times and we're getting various answers as well. It's not documented anywhere, and I think it needs to be addressed for the providers.
Okay. Can we put that in the follow-up Q&A then?
Perfect.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Debbie Dunlap. Your line is open.
Yes, we have a question regarding RUL scenarios. We've received two different answers. Does it go by the initial date that's on file or the number of months that have been paid?
The RUL is based on when the beneficiary first received the equipment.
Right,
so if they've had their equipment, they need to have had their equipment for 5 years.
Okay, because we've submitted the two different questions. One patient was Medicare, then went to a Medicare HMO, then back to fee-for-service Medicare, and the answer given us was that we have to pick up, like let's say 24 months were paid under Medicare fee-for-service, then they rolled in the HMO and then back to fee-for-service. The answer was given that when they went back to fee-for-service would represent the 25th month, even though it's been more than 5 years. But
so
then,
it's been more than, so they're basically telling you that you need to carve out the time they go to the Medicare HMO?
Yes, but then in question number 8, I mean, it's a hospital, it's not the HMO, but it's saying that you would be able to start new RUL. So I guess what's the difference between if they're Medicare HMO or if they're in a SNF or a hospital?
Me, that's a very good question, and we can certainly bring that back unless anybody else would like to respond.
Hi, it's Dr. Hughes.
Welcome, Dr. Hughes.
Yes, actually, Medicare HMOs are a special case. And so the problem comes when you change scenarios, then the answer changes.
Okay.
And that's why you're getting different answers. If you go into a hospital or some other facility and you have a break in service, that, you know, that doesn't affect your useful lifetime, at least as I understand the rules. But when you go into a Medicare HMO, if you were on the item in fee for service in the first place, it doesn't have to be oxygen, it could be hospital beds, whatever, the rule's the same, and then you go into the managed care plan and you continue to use that thing, whether it's oxygen or hospital bed or whatever,
uh-huh,
all the while you're in the HMO, and then you come out of the HMO and you come back to Medicare fee-for-service and you want to continue the oxygen, your hospital bed, whatever the rental thing is, you pick up where you left off. It's as if, for our counting purposes, our fee-for-service counting purposes, the Medicare HMO didn't exist. Okay.
Okay.
But if it's not a Medicare HMO, then the time continues to pass. It's not like a time warp. So I don't mean to be silly, but that's really, it boils down to that simple a concept. The HMO is a special circumstance. You get to go in, and as long as you continue the item while you're in the HMO, when you come out of the HMO and come back to Medicare fee-for-service, you pick up where you left off.
Okay.
But that's not true for any other situation, as far as I know. So, again, I'll defer to the PO people on some of these billing questions, but if I've got that wrong.
Okay. And can I ask another question?
Well, not if it's too hard.
We had an initial CMM that was good for a lifetime, and then we sent the research to the doctor to fill out, and he only put length of need 4, because from the time the research was effective, 4 months later, the oxygen equipment was returned, and we got it back stating that the length of need is not valid on the research CMM.
Well, I don't have any comment about that. All I will tell you is it doesn't matter what they put on the first initial CMM. If it's a group 1 patient,
uh-huh,
as long as they put 12 or more,
uh-huh,
it's 12, because the recert is required. So it doesn't matter if they put 12, 15, 99, 4,000. At 12, it expires, and you have to get your recert. Now, if they put something less than 12 on the initial one, then it expires when that time is up. When you get to, and then you've got to go get another one.
Uh-huh.
For the research CMN, any number should be acceptable by the system, and it will expire if any other number is in there that's less than 99, it will expire when you get to that number.
Okay.
Okay. And in the old days, when oxygen was paid for forever, that was important. You know, if they at the research they put 24 in, then 2 years after the research, it would stop paying because the research expired and you would have to go out and get another one. So, but as far as I know, there's no system reason that they couldn't put a 4 or a 6 or a 10 or a 22 in there. It's just if they put it in at the research, when it gets to that number, if it's less than 36, it's going to stop paying.
Okay, so we sent the 3 determinations, so we just can appeal it then?
You're not really asking the best person that, but I think the answer to that is yes.
Let me type in. This is Jody from Jurisdiction D. You're welcome. Also, when you are getting an extension to your initial CMN, it's important to note, you said that originally he had 99 and then he changed it to 4. It's important to note that you need to add to the initial. So if you had a 12 length of need on your initial and he only wants 4 more months, you would add the 4 to the 12 so it goes through our claim system properly.
or he would need to add, you know, like, so it would be 16 if he's adding 4 more months.
So I need to have my research changed then. Because right. He just added 4 more months from the date of the research.
Right, exactly. You would need to have it 16 months.
Okay.
That way it goes through the claim system properly, and you don't have any denials or any problem getting your claim into the system.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jody?
Yes, sir.
This is Dr. Whitten, Dick Whitten. I had a fight with my mute button a minute ago, too. I appreciated the frustration of the questioner who was talking about the cert request for records going back 6 months, and we were certainly aware of some of the concerns. I did want to add, however, that it may be helpful to remember that the cert contractor is looking for evidence that the item is needed and is being used. And each of the comments were related to the physician's record. It may be helpful that in that physician's record, the total record, there is a note on the pharmacy refill sheet or a note by one of the med techs or one of the nurses that evidences, for instance, that the item's being used, which combined with the physician's exam could provide both pieces of information. So just there may be other sources from within the physician's record other than just the clinical notes from the physician itself that would help satisfy some of what the cert contractor is looking for. But that might help.
Thank you, Dr. Whitten. Also, I would just like to point out on the recertification question, for patients, as it's written in the LCD, for patients who fall into Group 1, the LCD actually says the patients initially meeting Group 1 criteria, the most recent qualifying blood gas prior to the 13th month, needs to be reported on the recertification CMM. So I hope that helps with the recertification question we had earlier. But we can go ahead with the next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Tammy Felt. Your line is open.
Hi, Tammy.
Are you there?
Yes, we are. What jurisdiction do you bill to?
All of them.
All of them. Great. What's your question?
I just have a question about the 3 test results for exercise and portability. I'm trying to remember what year that took effect.
I've been doing this since 95, and it's been in place since then. Dr. Hughes.
Tammy, did you hear that from Dr. Hughes?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
How far before that?
Great. Thanks, Tammy. Thanks, Dr. Hughes.
Your next question comes from the line of Anna Maria Martinez. Your line is open.
Hi, Anna Marie.
Hi, we actually bill both Region B and D, and I'm calling with Orbit Medical. And I'm sitting in on the call today, and we've got a problem with some of our patients where we don't know, we can't determine if it's a true break in service claim or not. The previous suppliers out of business, we can't contact them. And the patient cannot remember the name of the last physician that prescribed or ordered O2, how would we determine if this is a new medical necessity and if a new 36-month rental period should begin or if it's a break-in-need situation?
Well, Anna Marie, if the patient has been continuously using the oxygen and they're just coming to you because their previous supplier is no longer in business.
No, and this is not the case. This is the case where the patient hasn't been on oxygen for a couple years now.
Okay.
Like maybe a year and a half or 2 years since they've last had oxygen in the home.
Okay, and you do need to make sure you have a thorough intake process and asking the questions. Obviously, if it's been 2 years, you're going to want to make sure you have a physician's order to provide, and you want to make sure that when you get that order that you check with that physician, you know, when was the need originally identified for this patient, and finding out, you know, if there was a break, you know, asking these questions up front, you know, what if there was a break, why was there a break? Ask that to the beneficiary and to their caregiver to figure out exactly why there's been 2 years where they didn't require oxygen.
Right, and that's what we are currently doing that. But again, like I mentioned, a lot of our patients, they have a hard time remembering a couple years back, and they're seeing a different doctor now. So according to this doctor, this is the first time that the patient is requiring oxygen. for whatever reason, they're unaware that the patient was on oxygen 2 years ago or why they were on oxygen 2 years ago. And the patient can't remember who the doctor was that last prescribed O2 for them. So I'm not sure, you know, what we need to do in these situations.
Well, you need to have a thorough intake process, and obviously asking, you know, if the beneficiary can't answer these questions, their caregiver, finding, and I would definitely recommend starting fresh if there's no indication that the medical need existed prior to the date that they came to you. So I would definitely recommend starting fresh.
Okay, and then as far as the narrative goes, would we just indicate that the information is not available, and if it denies, then send this to redetermination explaining this information?
So you're saying that you've already had one of these situations deny?
Well, I'm asking if this is what we would do. If we submit, because, you know, when you're submitting a break-in service at the BIS narrative, so you do the BIS, the pickup date, the delivery date, the previous diagnosis code, and the new diagnosis code. So would we just, the narrative, would we just do BIS and then add previous information is not available? And then how the claim is processed?
This actually sounds like an uncommon situation. So, yeah, I would just do whatever you could to find out when the original need broke. It sounds like you're saying you have a pickup slip, so there must be somebody involved. I would just make sure that you get as much information as you can, and if you can provide information that they did not need the equipment for those 2 years, that would be something you'd want to include in the narrative. Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Dr. Hughes, can I think there's one element I think is real important that you didn't touch on, and that's what justifies the starting of a new payment versus a continuation of the old. And that has nothing to do with the passage of time. There's only one factor that determines whether you start a new payment cycle or not, and that's is there a change in the medical need that justified providing the item the first time? Is there a change in that medical condition to the second time? And if the answer to that question is no, it's the same condition, then the answer is no, you don't get to start over. And if the answer is yes, whatever I had way back when, I got better from, I'm cured, I didn't need it anymore, life was good, and now we're 2 years down the line and I'm sick again, either with another episode of the same thing or something new, then that's a change in medical necessity, and that justifies a new payment. So break-in service, break-in knee questions are, you know, people often focus on the passage of time and how to document the passage of time and why the time passed. But the heart of the question is, what were you sick with in the first place that qualified you for the oxygen, the hospital bed, you know, whatever rental thing we're talking about, and why did you stop using it, and now why do we need it again? And if the answer is, as I said, if the answer is I need it today for the same reason I needed it before, then you pick up where you left off. If the answer is I got better, I didn't need it anymore, and now I'm sick again and I need it, then you start over. So that's what you need to look for in the record.
Yeah, and we are fully aware of all those rules, and that's what we do verify and look for. But, again, it just goes, you know, we've got a particular situation where the patient doesn't remember the doctor.
Well, I understand how hard it can be to track that down, but, you know, Medicare doesn't have any suggestions about how to do that beyond all the normal common sense things that everybody already knows how to do. You know, talk to doctor, talk to the patient, talk to family members. If you've got access to prior supplier records, you know, I mean, wherever you can go to chase it down, you know, there's no something special for Medicare about that. We do empathize with how difficult that is to do, though.
Hey, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. Thank you, Dr. Hughes. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Jessica Diaz. Your line is open.
Hi, I am asking a question when I'm billing Region D. My question is, we have a concentrator and portable that has capped, and the patient went 5 months without receiving any contents. So then recently the patient received contents and we billed them and they were denied. And then I sent it into redeterminations, and they're still denying, stating that we need a new initial. And I'm not understanding why they would be requesting a new initial. The equipment is capped. The patients had the equipment the whole time and just hadn't gotten tanks for 5 months. So why would that be denying?
So the both the concentrator and the portable, is it gas?
Yes.
Portable gas, both capped out at the same time, correct?
Correct.
Well, you're entitled to start billing for the content the month after the 36-month cap, but you're telling us that you didn't bill for the content until 5 months later?
Well, we only bill for the contents when the patient receives them, which is also confusing as to, I don't understand why the contents are tied into the concentrator, because you don't use the contents with the concentrator, you use the contents with the portable.
That's so, because the portable is an add-on to the concentrator, and so content is always going to be based on the stationary system.
Mm-hmm. So, but why, I mean, if we didn't provide a patient with tanks for 5 months, so then you're technically saying that we are okay to go ahead and bill for them, even though we're not providing them?
Well, if you have a portable gas system, you need to be providing that beneficiary with all the contents they need for 1 month. And if you are doing that, you can certainly even bill up to give them up to a 3 month supply of content, but you can actually bill on the anniversary date for that content. If they had a portable system and they weren't using it, is that what you were saying to me?
Well, then maybe he wasn't using it because he wasn't ordering tanks. The way
okay.
we do it is if they're ordering them, then we are billing for them.
Okay. You can't bill for individual tanks. It's a monthly charge
right.
or a monthly
right.
reimbursement you get. Right.
But I understand.
Okay. So you do need to just bill one unit every single month following the 36-month cap.
But, okay, so then that goes along with saying we need a delivery ticket to show that we provided the tanks.
That's correct.
So if a patient doesn't call in to request any tanks and we don't provide them, then how can we bill it every month?
Well, you're right. You don't bill for what you don't deliver. I think that's some miscommunication. If payment, well, first of all, the reason you don't, The reason that the contents are paid with the stationery is because that's the way it was priced. This is just a decision that was made years ago that when they're paying for a concentrator, the payment for the concentrator includes a couple of extra bucks to pay for whatever contents are needed for a stationary system while the concentrator is being paid for. That's just payment policy. It just is what it is. Once the concentrator is done being paid for, you have to provide contents, obviously, and you get to bill for it. You get paid one price a month for all the contents you need to bill. Your example is you go a couple of months and you don't deliver something. But if you don't deliver something and you don't, then they don't, because they don't need it, and you're conscientious, then you don't. It's not an automatic payment that you get even if you don't deliver something.
Correct.
Okay, so that's the bottom line. So if you gave them 3 months worth of tanks, and you instead of billing for all 3 months at once, you said I'm going to bill in thirds, you could do that. But then the fourth month comes and they don't call you and say I need more tanks. Well, then you shouldn't bill for the fourth month because you didn't deliver anything.
Right. Which goes to my saying is, for 5 months, we didn't provide any because maybe he was sick or who knows what the case was, but he's using his concentrator, not using any tanks. We didn't deliver any tanks for 5 months, so we didn't bill any. Now he called and requested some. We billed the 1 month, and they're denying, and they're asking for a new initial.
Well, I don't know why. You'll have to talk to the claims people at your place.
That's correct, Jessica. You'd want to contact the supplier contact center on that.
Well, I have, but I mean, I'm not getting any answer.
What is my
next level? Going to River Trust, and I don't have any more documentation to provide than other than what I already provided.
Well, if you'd like us to look at that, we would be more than happy to look at that for you. And I can actually give you, if you could fax an example, that particular example, to us at NAF, I'll give you a fax number.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay. It is area code 701-277-6532, and we'll look into that for you to find out why.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Elizabeth Skegg. Your line is open.
Hi there. This is Liz from Jurisdiction D.
Hi, Liz.
And my question that I submitted wasn't actually addressed in the original thing, so I'm going to address it again. We're trying to go paperless, and we're wondering what physical documentation we have to have on site. Like, we scan all of our paperwork into the system and attach it to individual patient files so it's available on request. However, do we have to have an actual physical piece of paper on site in a file?
Again, this is Jody with Jurisdiction D. As far as having, you know, there's a lot of records that are maintained electronically, which is acceptable, although you do have to make sure that you're able to support the authenticity of that documentation.
Meaning what? I mean, a lot of our, you know, SNMs
and CNMs.
Where it came
from, that it came from a physician's office, that kind of stuff.
So, like, fax transmittal across the top of the sheet or what? I mean, how else would you do that with any of your documentation that you have on file if you get them by fax?
If you're getting documentation by fax, you know,
which
it would be the same way
that
you're getting. I'm sorry?
I said which on the, it's considered acceptable documentation by fax per the policies.
Correct.
So I guess I'm not sure what, I guess I'm confused by that. How would that? Yeah, I don't know. How could you authenticate that any further than...
Again, you're getting medical records. Is this what you're asking, that you're getting medical records from the physician's office electronically?
No, over the fax. We get it over the fax machine. We get all of our, you know, our scripts, and most of our documentation comes in by fax. However, we also have, like, delivery tickets that patients sign. Do we have to have the originals of those in a file, like a physical file, or is a, you know, it's scanned into the patient's electronic file and shredded okay?
Medicare hasn't issued detailed instructions to any of us about any of these kinds of topics. So, as far as I know, anyway, there's not a set of official Medicare rules except around the issues of faxed signatures being okay, electronic signatures, if you use, like, an electronic CMN system, and so on. All that's out there in the manuals is some statements that tell us as contractors, particularly the fraud contractors, that in the event of an audit, we have the authority to look into your electronic record-keeping system to determine that the documents that are in there electronically are authentic, that you didn't alter them, that they're true copies, and so on. Now, how are you supposed to do that? We don't really have any official Medicare instructions to give you. What I will tell you based on my practice experience with medical records is that your vendors or your software, particularly if you buy a commercial electronic record system, they will have security and measures that will let an auditor come in and you'll be able to show that person, here's how we put the stuff in, and here's how it's secured so it can't be altered, so on and so forth. But my best advice to you, and this is what we usually tell people in Jurisdiction A when they ask these kinds of questions, is you really need to be talking to your attorney about what are generally accepted legal ways to produce an electronic copy of a record that if you're challenged about it, you're going to be able to think you're on fairly reasonable ground to say, I did it this way, and this is why you should accept it. But at this point, Medicare, as far as I know, doesn't have any detailed instructions to tell you what to do, how to do that.
So it's not a requirement that we keep an original signature on file. It's like if we were just to scan it directly into our system.
What Medicare says is that you've got to keep the records for 7 years. And it tells us if you keep electronic records, we have the right to authenticate that. That's all that it says.
Okay.
And I'd just like to add on a little bit. There is a special edition MLN Matters article that kind of addresses some of this information you're talking about, and I would recommend reviewing that. It's special edition 1022.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Heidi Molnar. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Darla calling from Jurisdiction B. And we have a question about one of the questions that we went to, is it Nina, went over about the overnight asymmetry. She said at first that there was no time limit as far as the testing, but then she said it needed to be greater than 5 minutes. So we were confused on that.
Okay, hi, this is Nina. One moment. Yeah, the question that was given was, does an overnight asymmetry test, the actual whole test, have to be a certain length of time? And there's no specific minimum sleep time requirement. It's just that the testing requirement requires a minimum of 5 minutes of qualifying values. So what they were asking is for the entire test, is there a certain length of time? And there is no specified minimum sleep time. Does that help?
Not so much. So there's no minimum sleep time, but the qualifying time has to be at least 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, so I guess they do have to be asleep for a total of five minutes at some point.
Okay, that's kind of what I was getting at, because I actually had a patient that this came up on, and we had trouble with that. That's why this kind of caught my attention. So it has to be at least 5 minutes. That's the problem we had. So I think we did run into it where it had to be at least 5 minutes for an overnight asymmetry.
Right. I mean, for them to meet the qualifying values, they have to have 5 minutes, a minimum of 5 minutes. But I think we were thinking in general of, you know, do they need to be asleep for 4 hours versus 8 hours, or is there a certain length of time? No.
Okay, so the 5 minutes. That does clarify it. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Simon, unfortunately that is all the time we have for questions today. We would like to thank everyone for participating in the Oxygen Ask the Contractor teleconference presented by the DMEMAC National CERT Education Task Force. An audio recording and written transcript of today's call will be posted to the CMS Comprehensive Error Rate Testing page at www.cms.gov/CERT under the Providers tab in approximately 2 weeks. Each jurisdiction will also be posting the transcript and audio file to their websites, along with all pre-submitted questions. I would like to thank our speakers, Jody Witten, Denise Winsock, Nina Gregory, and Mark Loney for their participation. Have a great day, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.